Hi, and welcome to the Provider Podcast by NHS Providers. My name's Adam Brimelow, and in this episode, we're talking all things NHS funding. We have Chris Hobson, NHS Providers Chief Executive, and Miriam Deakin, Director of Policy and Strategy, on the recent funding announcements for the NHS, what they mean, what was included, and what's needed next from the Comprehensive Spending Review. You can join in the conversation by following us on Twitter and LinkedIn at NHS Providers with the hashtag The Provider Podcast, and keep up to date on future episodes by subscribing to the podcast. Thank you. So it's been a momentous few weeks for the NHS, with key announcements on funding for the latter half of this financial year, and then the revenue spending for the next 3 years. We've also had planning guidance setting out priorities for the months ahead, and then out of the blue, an NHS leadership review announced by Sajid Javid. All that while trusts continue to operate under extraordinary pressure, dealing with the backlog of care, continuing COVID infections, and of course, sky-high demand for urgent and emergency and mental health services in the face of ongoing severe staff shortages. As always, we've been out there making the case for trusts, and we'll talk in detail in a moment about the funding settlement and the forthcoming comprehensive spending review. Worth mentioning, though, the important briefings we've published on health inequalities, system regulation, and the need for a new capital funding settlement for the NHS. And you can find all these quickly and easily on our website. And a quick mention too for our very successful NHS Communicate conference and awards. That was a great joint endeavor between us and the NHS Confederation. And on system working, it's well worth taking a look at a blog on the development of ICSs with just 6 months to go until they become statutory bodies. And that's a piece by Georgia Butterworth in the Health Service Journal and also on our website. But let's have a quick chat about the immediate NHS pressures that are bearing down on our members. Chris, you're talking all the time to trust leaders. What's the feedback you're getting as we start heading into winter?
Well, we know it's very busy, Adam. I mean, whenever we talk to trust leaders of all types, what they're saying is they're under significant amounts of pressure from a combination of different things. In terms of the winter bit, then we never kind of quite know what's going to happen, do we? But we know that we're going to be quite dependent on what the levels of COVID and what the levels of flu are going to be. We know that certainly in acute hospitals, we've got a very difficult balance to strike between managing pressures on the urgent and emergency care pathway versus ensuring we get through elective recovery as quickly as we possibly can. I suppose what I would flag at this point is that there are a couple of warning signs which seem to us to be not particularly helpful at this point. One of them is the ambulance service is clearly under very, very significant pressure. That's a worry. And certainly members are saying to us that they're also seeing increased levels of delayed transfers of care in terms of the number of people who are medically fit to discharge but can't be discharged. And that's really a function, I think, significantly, partly a function of the fragility of the social care sector, where we know that they are under particular pressure. And we still haven't felt the full impact of exactly what mandatory vaccination is going to, the impact that will have on the workforce. So as ever, everybody is completely on task, focused on what we need to do to provide the best possible care, but it clearly feels like it's going to be a bumpy ride.
And Miriam, that's a good point Chris makes there, isn't it? In terms of very often NHS pressures are discussed through the lens of hospitals, but actually what we're seeing is pressure right across the board.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly as Chris says, all of our members are reporting increased pressure on services. So for example, in terms of ambulance services, I think demand Category one calls is up almost 30% on pre-pandemic levels. So that's a huge increase in pressure for those services. We know that demand is rising for mental health services, and particular pressure on children's services, for example. And in the community sector, colleagues are grappling with the additional demands of long COVID, as well as still seeking to get people home swiftly from acute settings. So you're absolutely right, demand rising across the piece.
And Chris, before we move on to the funding discussion, just a quick word about this NHS leadership review, which seemed to come slightly out of the blue. What's going on there, and how much of a concern is that for trust leaders?
Well, if you're a Secretary of State and you've worked incredibly hard, as the current Secretary of State has done, to secure a significant increase for the NHS, and clearly with a degree of political impact, given the fact that the government has had to break one of its manifesto commitments about not increasing taxes, quite understandably, I think, that Secretary of State and that Prime Minister will want to ensure that that money is very, very well spent. And I think Secretary of State has been emphasising the importance of both leadership and innovation. They're both things that we know are really, really important in delivering effective care and making sure great value for money. So I think what's important for me, and in the press comments we've been making around this, is that there are two ways, in a sense, this review might go, or a number of ways, but two ways it might go would be, one would be, let's use it as an exercise to have a good bash at those bureaucratic pen pushers, which is some of the kind of commentary you see in the newspaper, which is really unhelpful and just simply not true. It's a tired old trope, in my view. But equally, there's a real opportunity, as the press release that announcing the leadership review and as the Secretary of State's been saying, to really identify where is best practice, how might that be spread more widely, and what can we do to ensure that those leaders who we ask to do a really, really difficult job on the ground get the maximum support possible. So there is, I think, a real opportunity here. We're very busy, there's lots going on, but I think there is an opportunity here, and I think it's important that the sector engages with the review, and that hopefully what we'll find is that what comes out of it is a recognition of what a fantastic job our frontline leaders do, but also identifying the places where we can give them more support to do even better. And Simon Stevens, I thought, was always very good when he said the NHS is at its best when it acknowledges that actually there are some things that we can do better to improve. And I think, you know, that for me is the kind of key message here. I think great leaders recognise that this is always a journey of continuous improvement. And if this leadership review helps us improve, then that's a good thing.
Let's get on to the funding discussion. We'll need to chunk it down into different elements. Let's start with the extra money for the latter half of this financial year. I think it was an extra 5.4 billion. Miriam, that was something we gave a pretty warm welcome for, wasn't it?
It was, Adam. We were very active in calling for urgent confirmation of the finances for the sector in the second half of this financial year. So it was good to see that announcement come forward. The 5.4 billion covers the additional cost to the sector of the pandemic for this next 6 month period. So that includes an additional 2.8 billion pounds for infection prevention control measures, 1.5 billion for supporting our efforts on tackling the care backlog, and that includes some capital monies for winter as well, which was good. And we were really pleased from a community sector perspective to secure some additional money for Discharge to Assess for this 6 month period alone. So that was very positive. I'm sure we're gonna come on to talk about our ask for the revenue settlement over the next 3 years, in which we argued for an extra 10 billion a year. So 5.4 billion for a half year for H2, that is looking like quite a good settlement for the NHS for the remainder of this year. And some welcome consistency, I think, in terms of the accompanying planning guidance for the remainder of the year. So people are continuing with their priorities for this year and commitments around mental health and community service spending protected for this year as well.
Okay, and obviously we've been talking about the pressures as we head into what promised to be a really tough winter for the NHS. Chris?
Certainly the feedback that we've got on the H2 bit is that obviously extra money is welcome. We don't quite know exactly what COVID's going to look like for the second half of the year. And I think people reacted well to the planning guidance. But I think the sort of theme of the day seems to be kind of, you know, quite understandably is prioritisation. There are a lot of asks, there are some very high expectations here, which is how it should be. I mean, you know, we know that we're here to provide fantastic quality of care for the nation. And it's right that we should push ourselves. But I think there is a sense of, I think one of the conversations we're going to need to have, particularly, I think, if we get into a really tricky and difficult winter, is that where are those trade-offs? And again, I'll go back to something I said earlier. Individual organisations will need to work out if they are space constrained and their workforce constrained, which we know many are, there are going to be some very difficult choices to make about ensuring safe care and appropriate care on the urgent and emergency care pathway, but also at the same time ensuring that we crack through that elective waiting list. And quite rightly, there's been a strong focus on the 104-week waiters to basically say, let's make sure we've got through all of those by the end of the year. Again, that kind of makes complete sense to me, but that clearly is going to be difficult and challenging, and more so if we end up with a difficult winter. So I think there are going to be some big kind of challenges for organizations. But I thought Sarah Jane Marsh, with her kind of customary skill on kind of Twitter, basically said, look, there are enough challenges around for the second half of the year without money being a problem. So let's not make money a problem. And my kind of sense is that for the vast majority of people, actually, this settlement will actually meet that requirement, which is hopefully there will be sufficient funding so that actually the money for the second half is not yet another thing on a list of very large kind of, you know, worries. So I think we should acknowledge that's been really helpful.
Okay, well, let's look to the longer term, moving on to the three-year settlement. And we worked very closely with colleagues at the NHS Confederation on a joint report that set out what was needed, concluded the NHS would need an extra $10 billion in the next financial year. Obviously, that's a face value. You know, when you talk about health funding, there are always huge numbers involved. But Miriam, what were the principal elements in that we really felt we needed to push hard on?
Well, that work was based on a survey of providers, and providers really highlighted the additional costs that they were facing in the wake of the pandemic and will continue to face actually for the next 3 years and perhaps for the longer term. So things like the additional costs of infection and prevention and control, PPE, covering staff absences, for example. People highlighted the additional costs associated with tackling the care backlog effectively across a range of different services. So this work was very much focused on acute mental health, community and ambulance services, not just on the acute sector. They also highlighted lost efficiencies from the last couple of years where, quite understandably, we've been focused on tackling the pandemic rather than increasing productivity, and in some instances lost income as well from private patient income and so on. So it was quite a fulsome report. Number of areas we highlighted where we thought that COVID had actually changed the underlying cost base of the service, and that led us to estimate that really we could do with an extra $10 billion a year going forwards for the next 3 years.
So a really clear case made, and shortly afterwards the funding announcement came through, didn't it? And there was a significant increase, but actually falling significantly short of what we've been calling for.
Yeah, that's right. So any additional funding from government is welcome at the moment. As Chris said, public finances are tight, and we do understand that. So government did find an extra £15.8 billion, which will come to the NHS England budget over the next 3 years. So that's very welcome. And the sector does appreciate that additional investment. As Chris said, I think the prioritisation that's attached to what that funding delivers will be really important in the next few years. It does fall short of what we've highlighted that the provider sector has asked for. However, helpful extra investment to get us through the next couple of years.
So Chris, we've talked a bit about that prioritisation. Obviously, we're in an environment where public expenditure is constrained and the NHS has had significant additional funding. But when you look at those practical choices that trust leaders might be confronted with, what sorts of things do you think could pose challenging dilemmas for them and in ways that could impact on patients?
Well, it is a kind of complex situation, isn't it? But I think one of the great things is that, you know, we have got, going slightly back, the leadership review. I remain amazingly impressed with the quality of leadership that we have both nationally, regionally, and in local trusts. And I'm confident they will rise to what is a difficult challenge here. And let's also recognize, Adam, on a bit of a process point, that we are kind of going through a change in terms of the way that the budgeting and the prioritization process works as we move towards system working. Increasingly, there will need to be priorities and plans set at an integrated care system level, and that therefore how that works is important. So, you know, wherever you look, there are difficult choices, aren't there? And one very obvious kind of choice is there are some interesting issues in terms of in the acute sector about how you do balance elective recovery versus urgent emergency care. When you're looking at an ICS budget, there will need to be the right balance between acute hospitals, community mental health and ambulances. I also think, and I'm really adamant about this, the whole point about creating ICSs is we are seeking to kind of change the balance between the NHS being a national illness treatment service and moving towards a national health and well-being service so that we can support our citizens to look after their own health and well-being. And you can see, given the scale of operational pressure we're going to have and getting through that care backlog, how difficult the current urgent emergency care pressures are. You can see there'll be a centrifugal force that is pulling all the money into the treatment of illness. And I do think ICSs are going to have a really interesting issue about how do they remain true to that vision of heading towards more prevention, ensuring health and well-being, tackling health inequalities, and also doing the transformation that we need. I mean, it's very, very clear that the NHS needs to roll out new treatments. It's absolutely clear we also need to invest in our digital infrastructure so that we can give patients a better experience. So, those are the kind of investment challenges and investment choices that I think people are going to need to make. I think what we're expecting, just again to be a bit dull and processy, is that there'll be a piece of work that will come from NHS England, as is always the case, that effectively sets out what the allocations will be to ICSs over the next 3 years, and then give people a sense of, okay, if you're looking at these priorities, some kind of sense about what the relative balance of the priorities might be and where the expectations are. And I think that planning guidance will clearly be a really important bit that sets out how do we kind of spend the money. And again, just one final point in all of that, Adam, is that that there is also, you know, we all rallied around and I thought did a really good job of helping create a fantastic NHS long-term plan that actually really set out a long-term direction of travel for the service. And obviously one of the questions that people have at the moment is, so exactly how does that fit within the current environment? And I think we need to be very clear in the planning guidance about exactly, I mean, the expectation I've got is that we are seeking to deliver all of those ambitions. The question I think might be, what's the relative priority and the timelines by which they're going to be delivered? But again, that I think needs to be baked into the planning guidance so that people are clear about where are we going on the long-term plan.
Okay, so let's just look ahead now to the next big thing, really, which is going to be the comprehensive spending review, because there's still some important funding issues to be resolved, aren't there? And the key one that we've talked about a lot is capital, also education and training, and something that you were talking about there, Chris, public health as well. So, Miriam, the comprehensive spending review, that's going to be a very big moment, isn't it?
Yeah, still a really pivotal moment for the NHS. So as you say, Adam, we really need a multi-year settlement for capital, really hoping that the capital budget goes up by a minimum of £1.5 billion for providers in the next couple of years. At the moment, the DH's capital budget is actually smaller than the backlog maintenance in providers. So capital and a multi-year settlement and some reform of how trusts access capital, really, really essential. As you mentioned, multi-year plan for education and training, really pivotal in terms of supporting our people in the NHS, and we'd like to see cuts to public health funding reversed. And finally, I guess worth mentioning, although the government has announced the new health and care levy and additional funding for social care via that, they also have a white paper on further social care reform in the background. So we'd like to see social care put on a sustainable footing as well. As Chris said, that in itself is a key priority for NHS providers at the moment.
Thank you. So we've talked a lot about the pressures. We've talked about the funding that has been allocated, the importance of the comprehensive spending review. We know that there's a narrative that sometimes we hear about the NHS always wanting more, some people even characterizing it as a kind of bottomless pit. Yet we know equally that there've been such fantastic achievements from the NHS in terms of overcoming the challenges of the pandemic and really driving improvements in so many areas. Chris, in terms of that narrative of the bottomless pit, how does the NHS, how do trusts, and how do we ensure that the achievements of the NHS are recognised and understood? Because clearly, in these times of very tight public spending, there is going to be that additional scrutiny.
Well, there's two or three things to say, aren't there? The first is we just need to remember the overall context here. The longer term context is significantly increasing demand for health services because of changing demographics, but also those fantastic new treatments that are kind of coming along. There is also, we need to recognise we are at the end of, or hopefully at the end of, we have been through a very long period where NHS capital and revenue has been squeezed. This is the longest and deepest financial squeeze in NHS history. And that inevitably kind of leaves a legacy. And, you know, if you look at the capital, that is a fantastic example of where we really have restricted access to capital over the last, a number of years. And we've now got, therefore, an absolutely enormous maintenance backlog that we need to kind of get through. We have got buildings that need replacement because we've hit one of those cycles where effectively that big building program in the early 60s, those buildings, many of those buildings are coming to the end of their kind of useful life. And we also know at the same time, we absolutely need to invest in digital like most other public services had. And yet we've just simply not been able to. So I do think it's really quite important that when we talk about, without kind of being defensive and without kind of sort of trying to reinforce the prejudice that we're a bottomless pit, I do think we just need to remind people of the kind of context that we've kind of been through. What I think then happens is, as ever with the NHS, there's that wonderful song about the river keeps rolling on. The reality is the NHS will continue to kind of provide as good possible care to as maximum number of people as possible. And that's, I think, what we kind of need to continue doing as we go forward into the next period. The bit I'm just really keen we should do is, I think there are some fantastic opportunities available to us in terms of, for example, what genomics can bring. I mean, just this month, we've announced that we're starting to trial that really interesting test where effectively with a small amount of blood, you can test for 50 different cancers off one test. That is transformational, I think, in terms of, as somebody who's had relatives who we've lost to kind of cancer, the importance of early detection, that is potentially revolutionary. So there are some real opportunities here, I think, to kind of use this extra investment to not just kind of tackle backlogs, but also to make the NHS, transformed and fit for the future. And that it feels to me is that the balance that we've kind of got here. And I think one of the things we just need to be careful of is it is hard out there at the moment. There's absolutely no doubt that the service is under very significant pressure. But we also mustn't forget the core mission of, providing fantastic care and improving health outcomes, but also recognise the opportunities we have ahead of us that this investment can potentially kind of buy.
Yeah, important to mention those opportunities, the positivity of things that are happening. But Miriam, looking ahead, the pressure really will be on, won't it?
Certainly the pressure is going to be on in the short term. And I think people are slightly unsure what the winter will bring. But like Chris, I'm optimistic. As a system, the NHS offers us huge value as a society. And has been shown to be incredibly efficient by international comparators. And as Chris says, it's a unique system, isn't it, that offers us huge social value, largest employer in the country, and is a network which really came into its own in the pandemic, shown to be very adaptable and very effective. So I have huge confidence going forwards.
Excellent. Miriam Deakin, Chris Hobson, thank you very much.